Welcome to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast, the show that takes you inside the Texas and federal appellate systems. Through conversations with judges, court staff, top trial and appellate lawyers, academics, and innovators, we provide practical insights to help you become a more effective advocate. Whether you're handling appeals or preparing for trial, you'll discover strategies to sharpen your arguments, innovate your practice, and stay ahead of the latest developments. And now, here are your hosts, Todd Smith and Jody Sanders. Produced and powered by Law Pods.
Welcome back to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. I'm Todd Smith.
And I'm Jody Sanders.
Our guest today is Ross Guberman. Ross is the founder and CEO of Briefcatch, and he has been a previous guest with us before. So welcome back, Ross.
Good to see you guys. I think it's been about 5 years.
Yeah, which is wild.
I was checking on that. It has been since July of 2021. And we were chatting before we hit record here about how the world has changed in the last 5 years. When you were on before, you spoke about leveraging technology to improve legal writing. You were doing Briefcatch at the time, I think, but Legal Writing Pro was still a part of what you were doing. Because we spent so much time getting to know you back 5 years ago, we kind of like to focus on really what's happened since then. So we will kind of abbreviate our introduction of you. A lot of Texas lawyers, especially appellate lawyers, will know who you are and what Briefcatch is because it's a product that both Jody and I are fans of and we use. And I think a lot of our fellow lawyers in our area are the same. So let's just start where Briefcatch is right now as opposed to where it was in 2021.
Yeah, I mean, it's hard to believe it's been 5 years. You guys look younger, by the way.
You're very kind.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, you know, one thing that's changed is I've really gone kind of full 100% tech founder, running much more of what feels like a real tech company, whether I'm well suited for it or not, than was the case in 2021. So I'm definitely in the throes of AI and of all the debates in our profession, adjacent to our profession about tech, the future of tech, with lawyers, with the courts, with the public, with pro se litigants, the whole works. And a lot of what we've done at Briefcatch has sort of followed all those trends that you were just referring to. So we have really moved from what was, like, for me, in a way more manageable, like fully coded deterministic product. That's what they call it, deterministic of editing rules, which, you know, that was easier for me to understand as a non-technical person when I started the company. I mean, now we have much bigger, broader ambitions. We're trying to satisfy all sorts of requests from different types of clients we have, and we're adopting AI. Absolutely. We're doing all sorts of exciting things with it, but we're still keeping our core product the same. We still have our universe of editing rules, and I still have, you know, things that I recognize from the product that you knew even back in 2021. So a lot of what we're doing here is kind of just a microcosm of what's going on in the profession at large and even with tech in general.
So I did go back and check out our previous episode. And what I remember from that, just to kind of recap a few things, is you had a pretty large list of rules that were encapsulated within Briefcatch even then. I think it was about 10,000 or so. My understanding is that number has expanded quite significantly.
Yeah, I think we're up to about 16,000. So that's a lot of things to change in lawyers' writing.
Mm-hmm. And you were also at the time, I think, maybe you were already beginning to shift somewhat on this, but you used to go around giving a whole lot of workshops, as I remember. And I don't think that's really part of what you're doing anymore.
Yeah, I have mixed feelings about that. I actually, around the time of COVID, so around 2021, I did a count. I was bored one day, as many of us were, and I realized I had done 2,850 workshops around the world. So it's not like I didn't pay my dues. But, you know, just because of reality, I, for the most part, stopped doing that, although I still speak to all the new federal judges. I just spoke to a bunch of female judges at the National Women's Judges Conference in Minneapolis. So I do a little bit of speaking still. I do go to some of our bigger Briefcatch clients occasionally, at least by Zoom for a workshop. But yeah, I'm pretty much out of what was my livelihood for, you know, solid 17 years. And again, all in tech, sometimes 18, 20, even 22 hours a day, to be honest. I won't lie, I miss it a little bit. I mean, I'm very extroverted for an attorney. I loved crowds. I loved traveling. I loved meeting lawyers and judges all over the planet. So I do have my nostalgic days.
So I think it'd probably be a good idea, even though we've referred folks back to that previous episode, just give us a thumbnail sketch of what Briefcatch is and what it's doing right now.
Yeah. So the original idea for Briefcatch was to take a lot of the different lessons in my books, also the ones I try to impart in my workshops, and make them much more manageable and actionable 24/7. And that's the problem with a lot of writing instruction is you can embrace it, you can internalize it at the time, like when you're reading the book, or at the workshop. But as I think you'll agree, it's very, very hard when you're an actual practicing lawyer and have 1,000 different types of pressures. It's hard to remember a lot of the tips and tricks and tools, not the trips. Those are easy to remember. So the original idea was a little bit modest compared to what it is now. I just wanted to automate a lot of the tips I would teach. So looking for wording patterns and then proposing alternatives. And that's how it started. And then it, you know, as you can imagine, you mentioned the number of rules a minute ago. And as time went on, I thought of more rules and more edits and then more exceptions to the edits. But that was the basic idea, is to help people edit their work when they're under the gun by automating a lot of the things that I would try to teach, again, either through my books or my workshops.
And the way that I receive it, I think it's the same for everyone, is essentially as a Word add-in. So Microsoft Word environment, either, I'm glad to say it is available for Mac, which wasn't always the case with every good piece of software out there, but it has been available in Mac for quite some time. I know it, you know, obviously was available to PCs. And just, you know, the way that it works, the way that I use it, and I think this is generally how it's delivered, is just, it's an option that pops up in the toolbar that brings up a sidebar, and you can actually work in your own document in Word and get the editorial suggestions and fixes from the software directly there in Word, which is one of the things I think makes it so powerful.
Yeah, we always, you know, one good thing is I did practice law, although not for very long. I know lawyers, I know judges, I know how people like to work. So we tried to keep it, as you said, very straightforward, right inside your document. But then we did add some other layers. So for example, sure, they like edits, but they like an explanation, like, why is this a good edit? That's also, by the way, a good way to learn better writing on the job. You get little messages. And then one thing I added later, I think beginning in 2021, but more in 2022, one thing I added that's become incredibly popular were examples. So it would show like, hey, this is Scalia doing what I said, or this is Kagan doing what I said, or Paul Clement. And those also give people reassurance, but they can be in their own way a little bit of quiet, tacit writing instruction as well, because you're getting exposed to some really short bits of really fine writing. So that's another thing we tried to add.
Sure. I want to mention before we go too far down the road that we recently had Chris Chandeville on the show, and you see Chris a lot on LinkedIn, and your name came up.
He's great.
In that conversation. And I like the way that Chris put it when we were talking briefly about you and Briefcatch. And he said, it's like having Ross as your editor living in Word.
So, I hope that was a compliment. Yeah, for some people that might be a nightmare.
I think it was a compliment.
I think so too.
I think from him probably was. I did take him out to lunch once, so maybe that's why.
Ah, okay. There you go.
He's being kind. He's quite fantastic, by the way. I can see why you would have him on your show. And he's also, I think, done a lot of consolidating with his, I think he calls it, brief writing ninja techniques. He's also taken what can be very overwhelming for many people and turned it into checklists and other things that I think are really valuable. So, you know, hats off to both of you.
I thought you would appreciate that reference, though. So then walk us through, I mean, my recollection is basically the beginning stages of Briefcatch, you were, or someone, not you, because you're not a tech guy, was hard coding in these edits or these strategies into the software. And you mentioned now that you're relying, the company's relying more on AI, but how do you make the shift from someone who's going around, gives, you know, more than 2,000 workshops and is not tech oriented, to becoming essentially the CEO of a tech company and delivering a product that is unquestionably a tech and AI functioning product?
No, it's a great question. You know, most people in my shoes in the legal tech world actually had a co-founder, like a technical co-founder with the kind of background you would expect, you know, an engineering degree from college, a few years at Google or Apple and so forth. So because I didn't know that I was going to be a tech founder and I just thought I was creating software, I'd never thought of such a thing. So I had to wing it. One good thing though is even my legal writing career is not my first career. Being a lawyer wasn't my first career. I am kind of lifelong learner type. And I actually have picked up quite a bit about coding and tech through osmosis. And I enjoy that. It's very stimulating and it's fascinating. And the truth is most lawyers, if they wanted to learn how to code, would be good at it and probably would enjoy it because it is not that different, right? There's a lot of logic involved, attention to language and the like. So long story short, I did have to learn a language for the rules, but it's not really code. It's sort of like a pre-coded language, natural language processing language based on, well, I won't bore you with all the details, part of speech tags and the like. So I did have to learn something akin to a code to write the editing rules. But then, as you suggested, those were converted into, you know, XML and other coding languages that luckily I did not have to do on my own. So that was part of it. For a non-technical founder, I have become quite technical. I've had to. But then the other thing is, just as in all businesses, including running a law firm, you have to learn how to hire, right? You have to learn how to hire well, and you have to learn how to hire for things that you're not good at. So I'm not good at coding, to put it mildly, or at least I certainly wasn't years ago. So I just had to rely on hunches, you know, or gut instinct, or try to get other people to help me hire. But it's just, again, it's a little bit like any other business. You have to wear a lot of hats and you have to sort of know what you're good at. And then you learn very quickly what things you're not good at and need to delegate.
I can't imagine what an arc the company has taken over the last 5 years. And if we've talked a lot on this show about how AI has kind of taken over. And we talk a lot about AI generally on this show, even though it's certainly not a tech-focused show specifically. But it's been interesting to watch.
I mean, any legal conference, yeah, look at any legal conference right now on any topic and you look at the actual panels, everything is AI. It's all about AI everywhere you go.
Well, you know, where people seem to get into trouble is not understanding what it is and what it does. And that's so important to at least educate people, even if they don't really adopt it as part of their legal practice. Knowing what it is and what it's not is so critical.
Yeah, there are kind of a lot of myths out there and a lot of like misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's unfortunate that I think the CLE world has kind of reached the saturation point on AI. I mean, I've had people who are putting on programs who want to stay away from AI topics because it's like all you hear about all the time is AI, AI, AI. But, you know, as we all know, you know, we have a duty of competence, technological competence as lawyers. And so you can make a pretty good case now that someone who's just completely oblivious to AI is exposing themselves to malpractice.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because, you know, if you just look at the legal headlines, you would think the number one issue is avoiding hallucinations and avoiding sanctions over hallucinations. And I have a lot to say about that, knee deep in it, if you're interested. But I think what you're talking about is the stealth issue that's actually much more important and is kind of the opposite, right? Not can you get in trouble using AI, but can you get in trouble not using AI? And I think we're probably at an inflection point now where you're talking about is going to become a much bigger story than the story about the pitfalls of using AI.
Well, you gave us the perfect opportunity, so I'm going to lob that softball about your thoughts on hallucination.
Go for it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, this, you know, for a long time, this has been, I think, even just empirically, the number one topic in the legal press when it comes to tech in general and Gen AI in particular, is this whole hallucination problem. So, you know, I've spent about the last 6 months of my life, and I mean my life, not my work life, but like 24 hours a day, it seems sometimes, dealing with confronting the challenge of hallucinations in our profession. So one thing I'll say, we're talking about kind of myths. So obviously when I say hallucinations, most people think, you know, I think correctly of the ones you hear about, the actual hallucinated case filled briefs that make the news. And, you know, it's the same story over and over and over again. Just the names change, the details change, the level of angry rhetoric from the court changes. But as we all know, if you use one of the standard LLMs, you know, Claude, ChatGPT, Grok, Gemini, what have you, there's a chance that it will, if you ask it to generate a legal document, that you will get very serious, somber looking citations and information or quotations from the cases the citations refer to. And then all that's basically BS. It doesn't exist, but it has the veneer of formality and people fall for it, right? And keep it in their briefs. And let's be honest, some judges have gotten caught too recently, keep it in their opinions. So that's the sort of like knee-jerk hallucination problem people are very familiar with. But actually, there are other more interesting layers. So very often nowadays, by the way, there's a much lower chance right now of getting a purely hallucinated case than there was a year ago, because again, Anthropic, OpenAI are onto the problem and they've fixed it to some extent. So what's more common now is a correct case that does exist with the right reporter number and the like, but then there's either something like a quotation from the case that's not in the case at all, or there's, you know, a statement of what the case means or what the holding was, those are inaccurate. So that's something else we've tackled. And then the third thing I like to point out is that this is, you know, you said I've been doing this for a while, and that's true. The problem of inaccurate discussion of case law is as old as time. It was a huge problem long before we ever heard the term Gen AI. Yes, it's true that not that many lawyers literally cited completely made up cases before Gen AI, but plenty of lawyers and frankly, judges said all sorts of things about cases, intentionally or not, that just weren't true. And that has nothing to do with Gen AI, and it has nothing to do with sloppiness. I mean, I guess it's sloppy, but it's human. These are human errors. So although Reality Check, which is our anti-hallucination product, it was sort of conjured up to fight hallucinations, Gen AI produced hallucinations. Luckily, I think for us and for hopefully the profession, it also catches all sorts of other errors people make in discussing case law that have nothing to do with Gen AI.
That gives us an opening then to move straight into reality check, because that is a new announcement, a product announcement that you guys have made pretty recently. I know you've been speaking on it and educating lawyers about it, and you kind of covered the basics of what it does, which I think is super helpful to reach that next level of hallucination besides just making up cases. What's the status of the rollout? Is that widely available now, or where does it stand?
Your timing is great for this episode because we launched it and we had like more interest than expected, and we were not able to scale it at the level we would have had to. So we're relaunching it, so to speak. We have a shocking number of courts clamoring for it, courts at all levels. So that's, you know, they're kind of next, like probably next week. And we are also starting to make it available to our customers. But we are getting feedback from the courts first because, you know, can't predict the future, but it may be the case one day that every lawyer who files a brief in America, at least in the federal courts, the first thing that's going to happen is the product's going to be run through reality check the court level. So we want to make sure that is seamless so that lawyers, of course, ideally in the perfect world, lawyers run it through it themselves and the courts have nothing to detect. So that's where we are. That's another reason I haven't been sleeping very much lately. We are very excited. Again, demand is like outpaced our expectations, which is a good problem to have. And we are getting it, rolling it out like as we speak, like literally right now, probably someone's getting it.
I saw an update in Briefcatch on my computer and I was like, maybe this is the day.
Did you? I'm glad to hear that. You're teaching me things.
Yeah, there was an update a few days ago. But I'm not sure that I actually have the full capability yet.
Not yet. Just a teaser.
Yeah. And also there for a while, I was unsure. You know, I've moved back into solo practice and I wasn't real sure if it was going to be part of my level of service or not. At first, I think the rumor was it was going to be enterprise only. But now I've since been disabused of that. I think maybe I DM'd you about it or messaged you on LinkedIn about it at one point. My understanding is it's going to be available.
You weren't the only one, by the way.
I'm sure. So it's going to be available to any level of practice because, I mean, solos do great work. Don't get me wrong, Ross. But, you know, we need these tools as much as the big guys do.
100% or more so, right? Because it's a huge burden when you don't have that infrastructure. Yeah. I actually learned something. There are 410,000 solo practitioners in our country.
Wow.
That number actually shocked me.
That kind of shocks me too. That's amazing.
Yeah.
But you're going to give it to the courts first. So they're going to be able to check our papers before we can using your tools. Lesson to be learned out there.
Maybe I'm good at marketing. I don't know.
Side check your cases. The courts may find them even if you don't.
I may not be that bad at business for a lawyer. Might know what I'm doing here.
I mean, and you've been public about really getting involved in making the product available to courts all over the country. And I think it speaks well of the company and the product that the courts are not only expressing interest, but really, you know, want to get it or giving you a level of demand from that source you didn't necessarily expect to get.
Yeah, it makes me nervous too. I want everything to be perfect now that we're talking about the courts. But in all seriousness, I am very, very blessed to have the trust of the nation's courts. It's very hard to earn that and I don't want to squander it. So yes, I mean, it did help all those years, you know, good lesson for people with an entrepreneurial bent out there. It takes a long time to build up that kind of credibility, not as much time to lose it, I'm told. So yes, I do have a very, very good relationship with the nation's courts.
Without getting too technical, can you kind of walk us through how Reality Check corrects the two different types of hallucinations that you brought up?
Oh, absolutely. So I'll just try to explain it like in normal terms. So imagine you have a brief, whether filed or not. The first thing that happens is we are extracting every single case that you cite. And then we're also linking to that what you say about the case. So that could be a quotation, could be a parenthetical, obviously your own words, you know, you're paraphrasing the holding, talking about what facts the court relied on, any combination thereof. So that's the first thing that happens. Now, we have our own proprietary system for tagging all that and for classifying and like what type of legal reasoning it is and the like. But that's the first thing that happens. So the next thing that happens is we take every single case you cited and we actually find it. We're not using AI. Like we're not asking ChatGPT, like, what does the case say? We're finding the actual case. We use MidPage. For the most part, we use MidPage right now. MidPage, for various reasons, is the best database for us. And then once we pull the case, we are doing the same kind of thing. So if you quotations, we're pulling the quotation. If you say, you know, the Fifth Circuit held XYZ, we are often either, if we're lucky, we're copying the holding. Often you have to infer it, especially from trial courts. We are then, in any event, we're doing the analog of whatever you did in the brief. We're finding that in the opinions, and then we're matching them up, and then we're verifying or not. So if quotation's a little bit off, if what you say the holding is exaggerated or just you know, way off. We note all that. And then what happens is it's all very straightforward, I'd like to think at least. Then you see it's just like a red, yellow, green system. You want lots of greens. Green means whatever you did is great. Case exists. The quotations are accurate. What you said about the case is good enough. Yellow means exactly what you'd expect. You better double check this. It's like a little bit of a stretch. Like the holding might not have gone quite that far, or the quotation's a little bit off. Like it's a real quotation, but it seems like you left out a word, or you're changing words without following the blue book rules for brackets. And then red would be exactly, again, what you would think. You know, bad news, this case doesn't actually exist, or what you're saying is very, very far afield. So you can see, given that, why it helps you beyond Gen AI produced legal writing, right? Because all those things that Gen AI does also happen in normal writing just because we're human, right? Now, sometimes it's because people are trying to play fast and loose with the case law. And, you know, one of the challenges, to be frank, in creating this product is, where should we draw the line? Like, should we, you know, you have to draw the line somewhere. Is this zealous advocacy, or are you actually lying, right, about the case? And, you know, not everyone's going to agree with where I'm drawing the line in the product. But at the very least, we're making your job much easier on whether you're a judge or a lawyer, because we're verifying a lot of things so you can like exhale. And then we're limiting the number of things that you really want to spend time double checking or triple checking.
I've heard of MidPage and I've heard good things about it. I don't use it personally. I'm curious though, will it get down into, say, secondary sources, or is it limited to case law or statutes?
Yeah, so we are adding statutes and regulations next. And then after that, that's by far the next most requested thing, statutes and regulations. Incidentally, people generally are accurate, I've learned, in what they say about statutes. Generally, they're copying from the statute. People don't paraphrase statutory language. And then, you know, depending on what people want, we have other techniques we've already figured out for checking things like restatements, law review articles and the like. But given what courts tell me and tell us and what lawyers tell us, 99% of what people care about is case law. That's what makes the news.
Well, and there's the most room for interpretation and error there.
Exactly, right? So if you think about what are people really duking it out over with statutes, it's the interpretation of the statutes, which is either in case law or in dictionaries or elsewhere. It's not really the statutory language itself. It's not the actual wording of the statute. It's what the wording means.
And just a quick follow-up on that, we have a lot of case law that's released here in our state that is outside of the official reporters that's still binding authority. How does MidPage handle that?
We identify unpublished cases and we let you know whether we are or are not able to verify them. So again, we're greatly reducing the number of things that you check, but we will never ever say that we verify a case unless we can actually find it. What you're talking about, of course, exists in other states. It also exists at the federal level, like Westlaw and Lexis, unpublished cases. It's tricky. It's not just a question of databases. It's a question of like, is it really precedential? What's its status? Another thing, these are all things you learn I didn't know. There's a day when it's like a kid graduating from preschool. There's a day when the unpublished case becomes a real case, and then you need to have a correspondence between the two citations. So what we're doing now is erring on the side of caution. We are telling you that something is an unpublished case and you want to make sure you verify it yourself, unless we are confident that we can verify it for you. It's just not possible, you know, the rate that these cases are issued in the form they're issued in, to give you full confidence all the time in unpublished cases.
Well, the universe of unpublished cases is just so vast. I don't know how. I mean, it's mind-boggling how many unpublished cases there are. So I know that would have to be a challenge. It seems like the right approach to me to flag it, you know, if you can't say with confidence. And I suppose in the flag, does it come back and say, you need to check this case manually or something like that?
Yeah, it's very clear that we are not willing to verify it. Like, we let you know you want to check this manually. Yeah, it will say not verifiable is the actual wording, and it will explain it's not verifiable in the sense that you should track it down yourself for sure. In most briefs, what that ends up meaning is that we're taking care of 90 or 95% of the things you would be doing painstakingly with the risk of human error yourself, and so about 5% will remain.
What about people who are concerned about confidentiality, work product, that kind of thing, in the idea that you're extracting information out of work product and putting into a third-party database?
Right. So we followed the most stringent security protections, the same ones that we follow with Briefcatch in general, which means we don't see a word. We at Briefcatch don't even see a word that you're writing. So we have, you know, again, you said you told me not to make it technical. I can't make it technical because I don't know all the terminology myself, but we do all the things that everybody wants us to do, you know, with encryption, with lack of data retention, data storage, and the like. So we're simply processing just to verify, and then there's nobody seeing a word that you've written, and there's nothing stored, and nothing is sent to Anthropic in our case, because we use Claude. So it's comparable to using Westlaw, Lexis, or any of those in that regard. Security, I have like an informal like PhD in security in the legal profession I was not seeking. So it's interesting, like with the courts, if you think it through, like what are the courts using it for to process briefs? There's no security issue, right? They've already been filed. Now, when the courts use Briefcatch itself on opinions, that's a different story. So there's like a higher security need than there would be. Now, it's different for lawyers using Reality Check. They're often using it on drafts of briefs. So it's work product and they want the highest security protection and we give it to them.
Surety bonds for court-related matters are a very niche industry, and there are very few appeal bond specialists who are as experienced as Port Surety Bond Agency. CSBA has over 110 years of combined surety experience handling appeal bonds. Whether the client is a sophisticated entity or an individual involved in litigation for the first time, CSBA is able to provide first-class service with their deep understanding of the appellate process and the various timeframes involved in getting a bond in place.
Okay, so that covers how you're dealing with hallucinations. I really like what you're saying on that. I think that's a great service, especially in a very timely service. You also are offering, part of the Briefcatch Next suite is something you call Site Check. How does that differ and what does it do?
So Site Check was a very challenging project, I will tell you, to fix blue booking errors. So it's like a big time saver, saves people some embarrassment. So we Site Check, again, same extraction procedure, except it only extracts your citation because we're not interested in what you say about the case for that product, only the case citation itself. And then it identifies and fixes blue book errors. But that goes not just for cases. We also fix, there's so many mistakes I've learned people make in citing statutes, like whether they have the section number, whether they have multiple sections. So we correct blue book errors, books, periodicals, legislative materials, the whole works. That was a tough product. That's one of those things you just think, oh, it can't be that hard. Then you ask yourself, well, how come no one's done it? That usually means it's very hard. Yeah.
How far down?
The blue book itself, I think most people would agree, is not the simplest thing in the legal profession. So, yeah.
Do you incorporate in that kind of some of the local preference? I mean, for example, Texas has the green book for legal citation on top of the blue book.
Yeah. So it's funny you say that. So now that can come up for air and I'm not drowning in Reality Check, we are adding Texas, California, and New York local citation rules. The good news is we already suffered through the sort of apparatus and scaffolding and infrastructure for citations. So this is going to be, relatively speaking, a piece of cake compared to the original Blue Book product. Would not want to live through again, to be honest.
This is a little bit of an inside joke, but I need to run Briefcatch and Site Check on one of my briefs citing a 15th Court of Appeals case and see how it comes out.
Oh, there you go. That was a clean inside joke.
Yeah. It was a clean inside joke, yes. Yeah, there's been some debate on how that should go. And I think the Texas Law Review folks now have announced the correct way of citing the 15th Court of Appeals, which is a new court that we have in our state, Ross, that I wouldn't expect you to be completely in the loop on.
I actually do know. I'm embarrassed to say that I do know what you're talking about, but it is funny that
Oh, I'm impressed.
Everything in America is controversial, even the 15th Court of Appeals and how to cite to it.
One thing I've noticed is you have a choice in when you're using Site Check to ignore the recommendation. I've done that a few times because I guess maybe this is in the new blue book, but it wants me to allow it to abbreviate the city names in our courts of appeals citations. And I don't know what it is. Maybe I'm old school and I'm just that guy that doesn't want to pick up the blue book anymore, but
yeah, it's funny because we get like aggregate. We never ever see anything at the user level, but we get aggregate stats on what blue book rules people are accepting and rejecting. So another one that people don't like is having an end dash instead of a hyphen between page numbers. I think they feel like life is short. I just don't give a shit. I'm not going to like...
This is a clean podcast, but okay.
No, I don't give a
darn. No worries on that. No, that's hey, not going
to I'm a tech flag. Founder. I'm allowed to talk like that now. Yeah.
That's right. Exactly.
I'm at WeWork. It's very crass here.
And who doesn't want to let one fly when you're talking about some of the things that we're talking about here?
Yeah.
Yeah, I have noticed that it's suggested in dashes to me for page ranges, which I've, as we talked with Chris Chandeville, I have a hard time accepting that, but I'm trying to be flexible in the way that I look at this and I can be persuaded that I'm wrong. So I'm keeping an open mind there, but I've noticed that. By the way, just kind of to wrap up on that point, if you don't accept, is there a way to like pre-program preferences within the app so that I don't get asked 20,000 times whether to abbreviate Houston in my sites?
Yeah, so we have a feature called Ignore All, and it will ignore it forever. Maybe you'll miss it one day.
Maybe I should actually open up the Blue Book and make sure that I'm not off base before I reject any suggestions, but...
You can also have a little bit of autonomy and tell the Blue Book to go take a hike. I mean, I have, other than in law review articles, maybe in Supreme Court opinions, I rarely see anybody following all of the Blue Book rules. In other words, our product is never a waste of money. It always flags something.
So, I mean, the sense I get is, I just remember going back to my big firm days as a young lawyer, we had a paralegal in our group whose sole job in working with the appellate lawyers was to site check our briefs. And it seems like what the product is doing now is it's getting awfully close to replacing that paralegal. I've got a paralegal, but I don't require her to site check my briefs like the old days, you know, pulling books off the shelf. I take responsibility for that, but your product is great for that. But it does seem like it's approaching that level of capability where it does, this is an overused phrase, but where it does sort of level the playing field between different practice types and sizes and so forth.
Yeah, I prefer not to think about replacing people because that's depressing and it's not our goal. And I prefer to think of it the way you are. Well, I'd say two things. So one is that these legal tech products are absolutely leveling the playing field and making it easier for smaller entities or less well-funded entities to compete with the big ones, which I think we'll all agree is a good development. And then the other thing is, for any one lawyer, any one firm, it's in its best form, and you know that's a high standard. It will allow you to spend more time on satisfying tasks and less time on tedious ones. And again, I think that's good for business because most clients really don't like spending X dollars an hour for people to be checking whether commas are italicized after EG and things like that. So that's, people have very strong emotions about AI, often like one extreme or the other. All those things are true, right? Yes, I'm not going to lie. It is going to replace some people in the profession. I hope they find better jobs, more interesting ones, but that's just reality. It's already happening, as you know, but it has a lot of very, very important benefits as well.
Oh, I love being able to run a kind of final draft through Briefcatch and catch those little last minute things that used to take, you know, a long time in a magnifying glass. And now it's going to tell me if my comma is italicized instead of me having to put stronger readers on.
Right.
But it is true. I mean, that type of stuff that does save the tedious task of going through, okay, well, did I italicize this? Did I miss an Oxford comma in here that should have been in this, you know, or did I not? It makes a difference. And I think it's also great for emerging legal writers because for me, it's kind of a finishing tool and a polishing tool. But for other people, it's just a good, hey, here's your first draft. What can I do better? What can I condense? How do I cut legalese? Those kind of things.
Yeah, I appreciate it. And, you know, this is a time, like a really common complaint among young lawyers is they're not getting feedback and mentoring anymore. And that's, you know, for many, many reasons, cultural, societal, technological. It's above my pay grade to diagnose the causes. But that's the other thing I think is important. A very good legal tech product can provide training, can provide development. The concern, of course, is often the opposite, that it's going to make everybody dumb and lazy and we're going to turn our brains off. But I'd like to think, and I know many users report that this is true, that as you say, it does help you get your work done faster, but it does also teach you and inspire you at the same time.
We're both obvious fans of the product. And there is never a time that I run Briefcatch on a brief that I'm trying to get out the door that it doesn't flag something that I either haven't thought of or just missed. And kind of to something you brought up early on, you know, to hold up as examples of good legal writing, Scalia opinions, other wonderful legal writer opinions, you know, that's very valuable to me, even at this stage of my career, to be able to see that and think, oh, you know what? That's right. And if that person is okay with saying whatever the phrase is that way, I should be okay with it too, because that's the top echelon of legal writing. So that's a huge benefit to me.
I think that's really important. And like, not to get too broad here, but I think it's one reason a lot of legal writing instruction fails starting from the first year course. People just declare these things like, don't use nominalizations, or you know, use short words. And there's never any proof offered other than just the author's or the speaker's opinion. So I learned very early on in my legal writing career that it's your duty, if you're the one running your mouth and telling people how to write better, you better show that admired legal writers actually do what you say. And my first kind of big break was this article I wrote about John Roberts. You know, this is many years ago now, because it was when Bush appointed him to be Chief Justice. And all I did was break it down into five specific techniques, one brief that he wrote when he was a Supreme Court advocate. And it was like, you know, nowadays we'd say the article went viral. And that's because no one had ever done it before, right? Like, you have to prove, you should have to prove that legal writing advice is actually followed and not just that it's a good idea. And my view has been, if I think it's a great idea, but there's no evidence that admired writers do it more often than the rest of us, then I stop giving the advice. Or in Brief Catch, I'm often sad, but I'll do it anyway, I'll delete the rule, right? So,
well, it seems like conventions in legal writing have changed over the last couple of decades too. It's people are kind of cutting out those old default rules in favor of a more conversational, perhaps less formal tone, which I find with. And it's nice to see when court opinions do it, because then I think, okay, well, if they're going to do it, I get to do it too. They can't tell me no.
Yeah, totally.
It's funny. There's one thing that hasn't been true for, and I finally gave up about a month ago, and it was like a funeral. I had to delete all the rules, and I was wearing black and in mourning. So for whatever reason, people refuse in briefs. If they write five and they write it out twice, in F-I-V-E, and then five in digits, I've been trying since the very first edition of Brief Catch to get them to change it to just one, but they won't do it.
I'm in your camp on that one.
It's sad. It's sad.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm with you though. We generally don't need it twice. I think until you get checks completely out of people's, you know, financial instruments and you have to write both the words and the numbers, you know, until that changes, I think you're never going to get rid of it.
Maybe the generation after us.
I don't think they'll even know what a check is, that generation, I hope. They'll see it in museums.
It won't be long before the lawyers practicing don't even know what a check is, much less have ever written one.
It's on the bar exam, if I remember correctly, negotiable instruments.
It used to be. I don't know. It's been so long since Todd and I have taken the bar, we can't tell you.
It was on the bar exam, and I actually remember I never took that particular class or secured transactions, and I learned so much studying for the bar. I was like, really? This is really interesting, but that's an aside.
You probably learned so much, but it was probably enough. I doubt you were like, wow, I wish I could do this for a whole semester.
You're right. I didn't regret it.
Appellate courts have demanding procedural requirements. That's why you need an expert who understands the complexities of every court nationwide. Since 1938, Counsel Press has been the trusted partner of the Am Law 100, providing unmatched expertise in appellate services from e-brief preparation to electronic filing. Their team manages document review and compliance, ensuring your appeals in expert hands from start to finish. Counsel Press, your trusted partner in every appeal. Visit counselpress.com today.
There was one other thing that I know has gone on recently with the company that I wanted to ask you about, and that is Brief Catch's acquisition of WordRake. I was also a WordRake subscriber and a big fan of that product too. And I mostly was happy when Brief Catch acquired WordRake because I thought, well, okay, now I'll just have to pay one subscription, right? But just tell us, just kind of explain generally what WordRake is, because your company just acquired it. But what was the overall strategy in the acquisition? And is WordRake, is that functionality going to be folded into Brief Catch?
Yeah. So WordRake was actually the first tech that I ever used, or legal tech. I mean, I used other tech as we all did. It was the first legal tech I ever used that I found exciting. And this is many years ago. So WordRake has been around a lot longer than Brief Catch. So it is sort of poetic that I ended up acquiring the company, as you said, not very long ago. So at the beginning of this year, 2026. So WordRake was quite innovative in two ways. So one was that, kind of as I tried to do later with Brief Catch, it tried to take legal writing and turn it into algorithms and rules. But the other is, back then, so you got to realize this is many years ago, it's more impressive then, it made the changes and track changes at a time when that just wasn't really a thing. So that's what kind of turned me on to WordRake in the first place. And, you know, tech is very competitive. There's a lot of consolidation. So when the opportunity arose to acquire WordRake, I was very interested, obviously. And we did acquire the company, including its patents. It also has a number of interesting patents. So there's a lot of overlap in what the two products we're trying to do. I'm very happy that we have this fantastic WordDrake employee named Danielle, who is kind of the guru and genius behind, if you probably noticed, the product improved a lot over the years. The last year or two of WordDrake, where they really improved their product a lot, I noticed, that was all her, and she now works for us. So, and she's a fantastic addition to a Briefcatch in many ways. So what we've done is, with the WordDrake users, we found out what it was they liked about WordDrake, and a lot of it was just certain rules that we hadn't really prioritized here, and we now offer all those rules. Like, we don't make a big song and dance about it. We just simply created them in Briefcatch 2. And then the other thing that we're toying with is, for some rules, to allow people to accept them all at once, which I've always resisted, but I'm coming around. So a good example is, this is not a WordDrake rule, by the way. It just made me think of it. So a lot of people, when they write briefs and they're copying and pasting, they'll have a mix of straight up and down quotes and curly quotes or smart quotes. So we're very good at flagging that, but it's irritating, I think. It makes people depressed because they have to accept each one and they realize how many times they messed up. So, you know, we're making it easier to accept all different changes at once. Otherwise, there was a lot of overlap again in the two products. And one thing that we have that WordDrake didn't have, we have choices, right? So if we tell you to change demonstrate, we don't just give you show. It can also be like signal, say, state. We have a lot of choices. So even with those new WordDrake rules that we have integrated, we offer more choices. And so you have more control than was the case in the original WordDrake product.
And are the changes showing in track changes now in Briefcatch? Because you are living in the Word environment.
Yeah. So we have a new modality called Briefcatch Express. I mean, what it does is, for people who are in a rush, for example, or who just like completely trust us and don't want to make choices, it automatically makes what would normally be the first suggestion for everything in track changes. You just push one button and it's all there. So that's an option. And then we have the traditional Briefcatch where you go, you know, card by card and decide what you like and don't like as well. So we actually offer both.
I haven't tried that one yet. That is one thing, like you, I really liked about WordRake was seeing the track changes and being able to visualize it there in my document. And like any other track changes, being able to accept or reject and then move on to the next. The cards has taken a little getting used to, but I think I'm there now. You mentioned overlap. It would make sense to me if the essential functionality of WordRake after purchasing the company was basically folded into Briefcatch. Sounds like it mostly is.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to have one product, not two, very soon, but there's people need a little time to get used to change. So there are still people using WordRake. I mean, they're paying us now because WordRake doesn't exist as a company, but they get it, right? Like, our salespeople just need 3 minutes to show them that we do everything WordRake did plus a lot more, and then they're comfortable. But it's a known phenomenon in business and in software that people don't like change, right? They don't like being told, well, the company doesn't exist, you know, but now you buy your suits or ties or whatever from a new company. People need assurance that the new product is safe.
Well, I know another topic that, I mean, we've covered this somewhat, but another topic that you have some strong opinions on is the use of AI in legal writing. And so I'd like to explore that with you a little. I mean, obviously AI is affecting legal writing at so many levels. I mean, we wouldn't have all the hallucination cases that we see if lawyers weren't using it, or misusing it is probably the better way of describing it. But let me ask you this way. What do you think, considering everything you've seen over the last 5 years and then some, as someone who gave, you know, legal writing instruction before there was AI, what is the proper use of AI in today's legal writing?
Yeah, I mean, believe it or not, even though I'm in the legal writing AI business, I do have concerns. I do have a heart and a soul, and I do have concerns. I have a kid about to start law school. I wonder what that's going to be like. So I absolutely think they should worry about education, about law school, about learning. They should worry about learning writing skills. All that is valid, but it doesn't really matter because there's no way this train is going to be going in reverse. I know I saw, you know, Berkeley just tried to ban AI for their students. It's not going to work. It's like teenagers and phones, unless you're in, you know, Australia or the UK, where I believe they have banned social media. So I like to kind of focus on reality, right? So we are not going to stop AI. So my take right now, as we speak, it is still not a great idea to use AI to generate documents from scratch. Obviously, I think it's a bad idea if you're talking about skills, but even if you're talking about very seasoned attorneys, there are too many things that can go wrong. And there are too many ways that the finished product can be very kind of easily identifiable as AI. And by the way, when I say that, I don't mean like, I don't believe in like shaming people like, oh, you used AI. I just mean there's a certain kind of AI style. It's not, by the way, just about M dashes or not only, but also it's more subtle, but it's all very real. So I don't think people should use AI for generation of documents. Now, on the other hand, I'm not naive. I know there are people who can't afford lawyers. I know that some documents are very straightforward. Now, if you use AI to generate a set of interrogatory requests, it's probably going to be okay. But any kind of really important strategic document, we're not yet there. On the other hand, there are a lot of great ways to use AI for things like fact sections, building fact sections. But again, you've got to decide, like, what facts do you want to emphasize? Do you want to go chronological or do you want to have some other organizational device for building things? No doubt about it. For building tables, images, for comparing things like witness accounts or competing accounts in depositions, or you guys are appellate types. If you want to compare like the trial transcript against some other source, it's great for that. And within reason, it's very, very good for editing. I think it's generally a bad idea to just take a brief and put it in ChatGPT and say, like, make this better. I think that is almost as risky as having it generated in the first place. But if you have some sort of intermediary tool or some way to ensure higher quality and exhaustive coverage, it can be very, very good for editing. For those who are going to do it, no matter what I say, I'll give a couple of tips. So at the very least, if you put a draft in and you just say, make this better, and I know probably right now 100,000 lawyers are doing that, whether I think it's good or not, ask it to, at the end, let it do its thing you want it to do and rewrite your document, but ask it to enumerate at the end every single change it made and then explain why it made that change. And even if you don't care and you're not going to read it, it will actually, this has been proven in many studies, but you don't have to read them. You can just trust me. When you ask AI to justify what it does and enumerate it, you will get better output. I don't know. I can't explain. It's over my head. You have to ask the computer science PhDs why that's the case, although I have an intuitive sense. But at the very least, you want to force it to list and then explain every edit it makes.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. I'm curious about what you said about legal education and some schools actually banning students from using AI. I know that there are some schools that actually require it as part of their curriculum. And so it's going to be interesting to see in the next, you know, few years how that plays out and who's going to be at an advantage in the marketplace when these young lawyers get out.
I think another related thing I'm seeing, which I approve of, is even offering certifications. Now it's kind of a thing, I think, in law school. It's almost like a major, like international law, or, you know, I did trial ad. So now they have, I believe, certain law schools are letting you take a number of classes and maybe even have some practical experience. I know because we get a lot of law students wanting to work for us, and this is why they get credit for it. I think that's a very good idea as well. You know, and again, like if you go to Vegas, if you like betting, who's probably going to end up being right? The ones who said, like, we're going to ban it, don't use it, you're not allowed to use it. All we care about is that it's not fair in grading, or the ones who are innovative. I think if, you know, you look at the history of legal education, generally the ones who are a little bit braver, let's say, or a little bit more innovative end up being proved right.
It does seem a little naive to think that you're going to educate a law student and send them out into the world where, you know, those first few years of practice are so critical. And we're seeing the trend now where firms are hiring fewer new lawyers, and the investment of time it takes to train them and everything, it just, the industry's changing. And I certainly hope that the law schools are sort of forecasting that and building that into their curriculum.
Yes, but I also understand the other argument. I think it's in good faith and it's well-intended. And the idea is, yes, you need those skills, but you still need all the regular lawyering skills too. And if you go through law school never really having to work and never having to struggle and having it write all your papers for you and even having it, like, you know, distill all the cases so you don't have to read them, in that way doing our students a disservice too. So what I would guess, and again, I did teach law school as an adjunct, but I don't anymore. And I'm frankly glad I'm not teaching right now. I think it's a tough time. But what I would guess is the really, really smart law schools will figure out how to give the students all of those skills and opportunities. And then for things like grading and papers, they will figure out some way. I mean, they're very smart people, these professors and deans. They'll figure it out. I don't know, closed book tests, or make them, you know, turn off the internet and make them write papers without Gen AI. I don't know, but I can guarantee you there's a way to do both.
Well, and you just ultimately, you can't remove the human judgment aspect and replace it with AI. And the places that balance that are going to have the better rounded students.
I think that's right. I think maybe law school doesn't focus on judgment and strategy enough. And if you remove some of the sort of antiquated elements of law school and turn some of them over to tech, then maybe there is more room for some of these more, you know, these higher level or more interesting skills and topics too.
Well, Ross, we appreciate this so much, and hopefully we can have you back and not wait 5 years for the next update. But as we close out, our tradition is always to ask for a tip or war story. I don't know if you've got one or both that you want to share with us. We'd love to have it.
Okay. So a tip would be, if you're kind of an AI, legal AI skeptic, a tip would be to give it something that you've written that's persuasive and say, if you are opposed to me, what parts of this would make you squirm because they're right? And on the other hand, what would be your best counterarguments? That's my go-to when people say, I don't believe in AI. I think it's terrible or evil or a joke. I'm like, well, just try what I just said. 99% of the time, they're like, wow, this was actually really, really exciting, like the feedback I got. And it also makes me realize the benefits. And I'll think it's a little bit less evil than I did yesterday. So war story off the bat, this isn't really a war story, but I think one of the most underreported developments right now in the whole kind of debate over legal tech and the profession, I don't think people realize how much AI the courts are actually using as we speak. They're not supposed to publicize their processes. A lot of people are really misunderstanding these sanctions orders and thinking that they reflect a general aversion to AI. It is not true. And just one example, I'm not telling tales out of school here. This is also public. There's been an influx of pro se filings overwhelming most of the nation's courts, appellate especially, but also trial. And they, you know, courts actually do take these seriously, but they were overwhelmed even before Gen AI with pro se filings. Now they're getting, you know, 50-page briefs that are clearly written by ChatGPT or Claude all day long. So they are absolutely like desperate for help. And they are using many, many AI tools and AI prompting techniques in many, many ways that just people don't understand. So that's what I think, that's one of the biggest myths out there, is that like the courts don't want the profession using AI. That's not true. And proof of that is they're using AI themselves.
Well, Ross, this has been great. Thanks for coming back. We look forward to, as Jody said, maybe not 5 years before you come back again, but we'd love to check in with you in a bit and just kind of see what's going on in your world and how the industry is changing. And we appreciate your perspective on all of this.
Thank you. And try to stay cool in Texas this summer.
Whew. We'll do it.
No kidding.
Okay. Great to be with you guys.
Thanks for listening to the Texas Appellate Law Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with your colleagues and rate and review the show on your favorite podcast platform. To connect with us, suggest a topic, or inquire about being a guest, visit texapplawpod.com or find us on LinkedIn and X at texapplawpod. Produced and powered by LawPods. The views expressed by the participants on this podcast are their own and not those of their law firms, courts, or employers. Nothing you hear on this show establishes an attorney-client relationship or is legal advice.